If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
The Cold War really did begin after the Marshall Plan, because it wasn't until that point that both sides, the United States and the Soviet Union, had decided to abandon the Yalta-Potsdam framework for collaboration and to pursue their interests unilaterally.
That was Ben Steele discussing the Marshall Plan.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today's guest is Ben Steele, who is Senior Fellow and Director of International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War, a new book that explores the famous US initiative to provide economic aid to Western Europe after the Second World War. I spoke to Ben down the line a little while back to find out more. So Ben, your book on The Marshall Plan has just come out in the US and UK, and I can see it's already garnered some excellent reviews. So perhaps we could start talking about the name itself. How much was the plan the work of George Marshall?
Well, the architects of the plan were people below Marshall in the State Department, and in particular two individuals, the famous diplomat George Kennan, who coined the term containment as it applied to the Soviet Union in a famous foreign affairs article in 1947. Kennan was primarily responsible for designing the Marshall Plan as a geostrategy to keep the Soviets from penetrating the parts of Europe that they did not actually control at the end of World War II. A second very important figure who sadly is largely forgotten today is a man named Will Clayton, who was Undersecretary of Economic Affairs in the State Department. And he, in many ways, can be considered one of the founding fathers of the European Union, integrating Western Europe economically, politically, and later militarily, was actually a vital component of the Marshall Plan. It was seen as being necessary to revitalize the European economies as quickly as possible and to ensure that they could cohere and act as one in the face of any potential aggression, either from the Soviet Union or perhaps down the road, Germany.
So you talked about this idea of containment and this fear of Soviet encroachment into Western Europe. How realistic a prospect was that in the years after the Second World War?
It was highly unlikely that Stalin would have used military means at that point. Of course, he was anxious to have his troops in as much of Europe as possible. At the end of the conflict, he told the French communist leader in 1947 that it was extremely unfortunate that the Soviet Union was unable to occupy Paris. But he would not have been foolish enough to try to send tanks into Western Europe. Having said that, local communist parties, particularly in Italy and France, were extremely powerful in 1947. They were both parts of coalition governments at the time. And of course, they received tremendous moral and other support from the Soviet Union. So these were considered by the United States effectively to be Soviet fifth columns within Western Europe.
And so the Marshall Plan involved economic assistance to quite a large number of countries in Europe. What kind of money are we talking about in total?
Right. In 1948 dollars, we're talking about $13.2 billion spread over 4 years. It was very important to Kennan to do this over a four-year period to demonstrate to Western Europe that the United States was here to stay. It wasn't going to abandon Western Europe. It wasn't going to go home and retreat into isolationism as it had after World War I. But to put that number, $13.2 billion, in context, that was about 1.1% of U.S. GDP, 2.6% of recipient country GDP. And as a percentage of U.S. output today, we're talking about $800 billion.
That's clearly a large amount of money. And I can imagine nowadays if someone came forward in America and said, we want to give $800 billion to Europe, there might be quite a lot of opposition to that. How were they able to get this through against political opponents and also for the public at large?
It was an extreme domestic challenge. In fact, the effort to push the Marshall Plan through a Republican Congress that was very anxious to cut taxes and have a peace dividend was widely referred to as the Marshall Plan to pass the Marshall Plan. And there's one individual in particular who deserves enormous credit. Marshall himself says the plan should have in some capacity be named after him, is Republican Senator Arthur Vandenberg. He was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a one-time isolationist in the 1930s, who changed his views quite dramatically after Pearl Harbor, decided the United States could no longer consider itself protected by its two oceans. The world had become too small. And without Arthur Vandenberg's efforts, it is highly unlikely that the Marshall Plan could have gotten enough Republican support to actually have passed into legislation, which it did in April 1948.
And then on the European side, what kind of reaction was there from the various European countries to this promise of economic assistance?
Well, the person who picked up the ball and ran with it the quickest and the most enthusiastically was, of course, the British Foreign Minister, Ernest Bevin. And that was partly due to the efforts of Marshall's deputy, Dean Acheson. When Marshall made his famous speech adumbrating what would become the Marshall Plan at Harvard in June of 1947, he deliberately delivered the message in a very low-key way. He wanted the ideas to germinate and percolate a bit in the United States. He didn't want splashy headlines, and he didn't get them. But Acheson was very concerned that the big message might be missed in Europe. So he called together a group of British newsmen just before Marshall's speech and said, "This is going to be big stuff. Whatever time of night it is," he said, "wake up, Ernie." And Bevin clearly got the message. And immediately after hearing the speech, he contacted his French counterpart, Georges Bidault. He met with Bidault in Paris to plan their strategy, which in conjunction with the Americans was to lure the Soviet foreign minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, to Paris in order to negotiate the possibility of the Soviet Union participating in the Marshall Plan. But the actual aim was to encourage him to storm out so that he himself, and of course Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union, would take the responsibility for dividing Europe and not the United States.
So the idea was that the Americans would offer Marshall Plan aid to the Soviet Union, but knew they'd never accept it. So was America happy to accept the consequences of potential further polarization in what then became the Cold War?
I wouldn't use the term happy. It was a last option. But Marshall had spent 6 weeks in March and April in Moscow negotiating with Molotov and Stalin over Germany, trying to find some means of producing a peace treaty and unifying the country. But the differences between them were just irreconcilable. There was a narrow issue that divided them. That was reparations. Stalin insisted on at least $10 billion in reparations from the Western occupied part of Germany. In current dollars, that would be a little over $100 billion. The Americans were absolutely unwilling to consider that because at the time, they were keeping Western Germany alive. So $10 billion in reparations from Western Germany would have effectively have been financed by the United States itself. It had made that mistake after World War I and wasn't about to repeat it. But there was a much bigger split between the two, and that was that neither the United States nor the Soviet Union could afford to have a unified Germany as an ally of the other. So when Marshall came home after the stalemate in Moscow in April of 47, he made a famous radio address in which he said, "The patient is sinking while the doctors deliberate." What he was trying to get across was that cooperation with the Soviet Union was effectively over. If the United States did not take immediate unilateral action to revive Western Germany and Western Europe in general, which was really sinking into disorder and chaos, Britain in particular, the United States itself was going to be faced with a major economic and physical security threat.
Clearly, the Soviet Union decided they didn't want to participate in the Marshall Plan. But what about the Eastern European countries that had fallen under Soviet sway? What was their response?
This is one of the most fascinating parts of the story. Stalin had early on actually considered trying to participate in the Marshall Plan because he was a Marxist ideologue and really believed that the United States had to give billions of dollars to Europe in order to prop up its own industry, which was, of course, suffering from some overcapacity after the war. But he believes the inevitable crisis of capitalism had come and that perhaps he could get unconditional aid from the United States, just as he had through Lend-Lease during the war. He also wanted to participate in order to try to undermine it from within and make sure that the United States could not impose terms. And initially, he actually told the satellite states in Eastern Europe to participate in discussions in order to encourage them to storm out and make clear that the American conditions would be unacceptable, in particular the revival of Western Germany. The problem Stalin faced was that the Czechs in particular were so enthusiastic that he did not actually trust them. He did not believe that they would actually storm out of an aid conference, and he reversed himself entirely, insisting that they could not participate in any means, even in order to show their displeasure with aspects of the American initiative. And I argue in the book that the Cold War really did begin after the Marshall Plan, because it wasn't until that point that both sides, the United States and the Soviet Union, had decided to abandon the Yalta Potsdam framework for collaboration and to pursue their interests unilaterally. And in particular, Stalin cracked down on Eastern Europe violently after announcement of the Marshall Plan. Prior to the Marshall Plan, he was willing to tolerate coalition governments of sorts in Poland and Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. But after the Marshall Plan, he pushed out all the remaining democratic forces in Eastern Europe and imposed a strict regime of fealty to Moscow.
And so this is something that you believe the American framers of the Marshall Plan were not happy about, but they were willing to accept it as a price to shore up Western Europe. Is that right?
Absolutely. The State Department was very clear about this. You can see this in internal memoranda. FDR's vision for the post-war world had been widely described as one world. The United Nations, for example, was supposed to be a forum for cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union to maintain peace and stability around the world. Now, the Truman administration was going to consciously be pursuing a foreign policy based on the idea of two worlds, a democratic capitalist world and an authoritarian communist world. And the dividing line in Europe was going to be very clear. And the United States very consciously wrote off countries in Central and Eastern Europe that really did want desperately to participate in the Marshall Plan, in particular, Czechoslovakia and Poland.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
You've talked a bit about Germany already. A lot of the other Western European countries had very recently been at war with Germany. So how did they feel about Germany receiving significant economic aid from America?
The French in particular were furious about this. In fact, the French were just about as ruthless in their occupation of Germany as the Soviets were. They were ripping up factories and bringing them back to France as reparations. And they were very, very concerned about the United States reversing the so-called Morgenthau Plan. This was a plan in 1944 to deindustrialize Germany, effectively to pasteurize it, to make sure it could never threaten its neighbors again. And so France really had to be drawn kicking and screaming into the Marshall Plan because of their concerns about the U.S. focus on reviving the West German economy as quickly as possible. And I should emphasize that the Marshall Plan would never have succeeded unless the United States had given France and Britain firm security guarantees, because they were very concerned about Germany, not just the Soviet Union, in the form of NATO, which was created in 1949. And the creation of NATO, I believe, should be credited first and foremost to the British Prime Minister, Ernest Bevin, who convinced the United States that these security guarantees were going to be fundamental, in particular because the United States was demanding Western European economic integration, and that meant that these countries would no longer be self-sufficient. If they were going to have to depend on each other economically, that meant, for example, that Germany could cut off coal supplies at any point in time, or the Soviets might come to control Germany and cut off coal supplies. So it was going to be vital that the United States not just provide economic aid, but provide clear-cut security guarantees.
What kind of uses did the European countries put the money to, and how far was this stipulated by the United States?
You know, the U.S. view on this was really quite schizophrenic. On the one hand, Marshall was quite insistent that the details of the plan should be worked out in Europe on its own as a grouping and submitted to the United States. But as you can imagine, the Europeans had difficulty cooperating, and they also had very different visions about how they wanted to proceed. So in the end, the Americans did try to impose certain conditions, very different conditions in different countries, but they largely failed. The one condition that they were able to impose, which was by far the most important to them, was to keep the local communist parties out of government. In Italy and France, in May of 47, just before Marshall's speech, the communists were booted out of government and they were never allowed back in. And I believe that's one of the reasons why business relationships and investment began to revive so quickly after announcement of the Marshall Plan, because people on the ground understood now that the Americans would do what it takes to make sure that the communists would not come back into power. But Italy and France pursued very, very different strategies with their Marshall funding. French pursued their Monnet plan for national industrial modernization, despite the fact that the Americans were constantly cutting off aid and turning it back on, trying to get the French to focus on fiscal and monetary stabilization. And the Italians did just the opposite. The Americans were encouraging them constantly to have some sort of industrial modernization plan like the French, but they pursued a strict policy of fiscal and monetary stabilization, insisted on a sort of neoliberal agenda of allowing the economy to revive through private enterprise. And I should emphasize that both of those approaches were largely successful. So each country pursued its own way forward with, as I said, the one proviso that the communists not be allowed back into government.
And here in Britain, I believe Britain was actually the largest recipient of Marshall Plan money. What kind of uses was this aid put to in Britain?
In Britain, most of the money was actually used to retire debt. As you can imagine, the Truman administration wasn't entirely happy with British economic policy. The new Labour government was busy nationalizing firms. And in the British occupation zone of Germany, they were also encouraging nationalization, which was totally unacceptable to the Americans. And they put an end to that after the so-called bizonal fusion in Germany. But I think it's very important to emphasize that despite the fact that the Truman administration had very great differences on economic policy with the British, with the French, and the Italians, the Americans were very supportive of the so-called NCL, non-communist left in these countries, because they believed that the NCL had democratic legitimacy. And it was the first priority of the Truman administration to make sure that none of these countries succumbed to the temptation of communism. And so that is the reason why the Truman administration tolerated policies which they thought were misguided, except in one country, as you can imagine, in West Germany, where the United States was basically a dictator, largely a benign dictator, but a dictator nonetheless. General Lucius Clay, the military governor on the ground, for example, refused to allow the Social Democrats to nationalize various industries. He was determined to create a West German state first, which he hoped would come to be controlled by the center-right and Konrad Adenauer, which was against such nationalization. And of course, he was very happy when that did come to pass in September of 1949.
A lot of Western Europe experienced an economic recovery in the late 40s, early 1950s. How far do you think the Marshall Plan was responsible for that?
Well, you know, the early eulogistic accounts of the Marshall Plan ascribe virtually the entire remarkable recovery to the Marshall Aid itself. It was only a few decades later when economists started turning their statistical tools on the subject and expressed a bit more skepticism about it. Basically, what the economists found is that indeed something was going on here. There was an enormous recovery in output between the time that the Marshall Plan was announced in 47 and the time it was wrapped up in mid-1952. Industrial output increased by about 60%. To put that in perspective, EU in the 5 years before the financial crisis in 2008, saw output increase by 15%. So something was clearly going on. But when they looked at the expected Keynesian mechanisms by which this recovery could have been affected, for example, the ability to import more because these countries were short of dollars, they didn't find a large effect. Was it that government spending was higher than it would have been? Well, actually, no. Government spending as a percentage of GDP fell across the Marshall countries during those years. So I think the effect came from two factors in particular that were more difficult to quantify. The first was that George Kennan had always emphasized that the most important effect of the Marshall Plan would be psychological. That is, convincing the Europeans that the Americans were not going home, would not retreat into isolationism, would provide for their security. I think that had an enormous stimulative effect on private enterprise. As I emphasized earlier, Kennan was very anxious that this be a multi-year program in order to make this clear, that this was not the United States just giving a sum of money and retreating into isolationism again. The second most critical factor was the reintegration of Germany into the West European economy. Before the war, Germany had been the primary capital goods supplier for Europe. Germany basically traded capital goods for food and other commodities. But after the war, the United States was the primary capital goods supplier in Europe. And this was running down critically the stash of dollar foreign reserves in Western Europe. So one of the ambitions of the United States was to replace itself as the primary capital goods supplier to Europe with Western Germany So Western Germany would be put back into its old role as quickly as possible. And this was enormously successful. And together with the security guarantees that were provided to Western Europe, this had an enormous stimulative effect.
Taking the Marshall Plan as a whole, looking at it economically, politically, diplomatically, how far would you argue that it was actually a success?
Oh, I would argue that it was an enormous success. Let me read you an extremely prescient statement from a Republican senator back in October 47 as the Marshall Aid was being developed, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. He wrote to Vandenberg, who passed it on to Marshall, that, quote unquote, the recovery of Western Europe is a 25 to 50 year proposition. And the aid which we extend now and in the next 3 years will in the long future result in our having strong friends abroad. Now, if you advance forward to 1989 and the collapse of the Berlin Wall, you see that the Soviet alliances crumbled immediately once that structure was taken down, whereas the institutions that the United States built with its Western European partners in the early years after the Second World War, I'm thinking in particular of NATO and the European Union, were as attractive as ever. And I think this is really perhaps the finest testimony to the long-term success of the Marshall Plan.
Just finally, ever since the Marshall Plan was inaugurated, people have talked of using this kind of idea again to try and resolve other issues around the world.
That's right.
I mean, how far do you think the Marshall Plan is a model we should still be following?
Well, you know, when I set out to write this book, I think the thing that intrigued me most about the Marshall Plan was the endless desire to repeat it. In the past 5 years alone, there have been calls for new Marshall Plans in Ukraine, in Greece, in Southern Europe, in North Africa, in Gaza, and most recently in Syria. But we've never seen anything even remotely similar to the Marshall Plan being implemented. And I think that speaks to the unique historical circumstances at the time. And it also speaks to some of the failures of economic intervention in more recent times. Consider American Reconstruction Aid in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States has spent over $200 billion on reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in current dollars, that's more than 50% more than the entirety of Marshall Aid. Yet the United States has almost nothing to show for it. And I think the primary reason is the complete absence of internal and external security in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as I had emphasized earlier, the provision of just that sort of security through NATO was actually vital to the success of the Marshall Plan.
So that was Ben Steele. The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War, is due to be published today, the 15th of March, in the UK, by Oxford University Press. And in the US, it's already on sale, published by Simon & Schuster. Okay, so that's about all for today, but please do listen in again on Monday for more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.